Just as a way to introduce myself, I used to be a physicist, then I became a neuroscientist, and now I'm slowly becoming a psychologist. So please don't shoot at me if you find that I'm not fulfilling some of your expectations. I got interested in human memory a few years ago, which I think it's a fascinating topic because we are all humans and memory is extremely important for us. So I don't have to convince you at least why my interests are important. And I really want to understand the aspects of memory which are unique to us, to human. Unfortunately, it makes it very difficult then to study with the modern neuroscience techniques because you obviously cannot operate a human and stick electrodes and do recordings which are science-oriented. But you can do very interesting experiments. And that's what psychologists do. So I'm in the process of learning the field as developed by psychologists and trying to apply some of the techniques of neuroscience to study this. Memory has it's a huge field, obviously. There are different types of memories from immediate iconic memory, which lasts for a few milliseconds, to working memory, long-term memory, short-term memory, a lot of stuff. So I will mostly present one project you could think about it as episodic memory, the thing that allows us to remember things that happened to us, which are unique, let's say, to our lives. And if I have time, I will mention another thing about long-term memory, but I strongly suspect that I will never make it to it. So we can remember things, right? We can tell stories to each other, what happened to us, what happened this morning, what happened yesterday, a year ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago, some people can say this. I want to study this in a kind of quantitative way. It's of course very difficult because everybody has unique experiences and we don't really know exactly what happened to you if you tell me the story about 50 years ago. So psychologists developed some paradigms to do it in the lab. And one particular paradigm, which I will mostly focus today, is called free recall. And it's a very simple thing. So I could do an experiment right here on you. It will take me a few minutes, but I think it's good that you will exactly know what I'm talking about. And I usually have a list of words, but now I forgot. I just take my paper and I will randomly read you a few words. Just listen carefully. I try to not to miss any words that I tell you. So just I really randomly go on my paper. So I say group, water, monastery, boy, violin, engineer, overlap, vector, statistic, matrix, reason, encoding, neuron, structure. Okay, so I don't even remember exactly how many words I read to you, but around 10, a bit more than 10. So now what I want you to do, just try to, if you have a piece of paper and a pen, try to write words that I told you. If not, then just, just try to think of them and count how many words you can recall. Yeah, I give you like roughly 1 minute for this. I know I'm distracting you from lunch, but that's the last experiment I do today. So. All right, so let's say that's an experiment. Now, to get an idea of the results, so the list was about 12 words. So is there anybody who remembered 12 words, all 12 words? Raise the hand. 10 words, somebody remembered 10 words? Raise the hand. 8 words. Okay, we start getting hands at 8 words, 6 words, majority of the people, Okay, and I guess there are people who are worse than that. Okay, so that's a problem. I think that's a very remarkable result, right? I read 12 words to you, you were listening to them, nothing more or less distracted you, and you cannot repeat them, okay? And I'm sure that you remember all the words. So if I would remind you of a word, you would know exactly. Now, because I didn't mark them, I cannot do the experiment. But I can assure you that if I would ask you about a particular word, you would know very well that this is it. So you remember the words, and you cannot recall them, right? And that happens in real life all the time, you know, every day. And if you get you know, older, it will happen to you more and more. So the question is, can we kind of make sense of this data, understand it quantitatively? So people, this is a very popular paradigm in psychology. People studied it for more than 100 years, and there were some quantitative results. And basically, very few people did like systematic studies of varying lists of words, but basically what people saw is that if you increase the number of words in the list, so let's call this L, and this can be anything from one word to the latest that I know of people studied was around 200 or few hundred words. And here you measure, so you do many experiments, you average the results, so let's say this is the words that you can recall R. So it goes like some kind of a power law, of course there is a huge variability. And this is as opposed to the number of words that you can recognize. So if I do, I will talk a bit about later. If you try to estimate how many words you actually remembered, then this is much better, right? So this goes much, much, much better. So this is a very poor performance. It's a difficult task, right, to recall words. And as far as I can tell, there is no real, you know, at least before we started thinking of this, there is no real kind of explanation for this behavior. So this is very, very crudely is about square root of L. It was like square root of L. So if I increase the number of words by 4, you will remember twice, yeah.
Does this depend on, for instance, by which language?
Okay, so I only know the experiments in English, and of course the published experiments are all with graduate students. It depends on many things. Depends on whether I speak fast or I speak slow, if I give you some time in between. So there are a lot of details here that people studied very, very carefully, which I don't want to go into them. I just want to focus on the performance, just how many words you can recall. I don't know if different languages have some systematic.
Is this a problem of like remembering concepts? Like, you know, yeah. Or is like number of letters or phonemes, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Is that data all auditory stimuli, or is it?
Yeah, you can do it auditorily, you can flash it on the screen. There are some tiny differences, but again, I don't know. I want just to focus on the main thing. Yes?
Let's presume, like, untrained people, I mean, I'm sure they're right to remember all 200 words.
Yeah, there are people who can remember behave much better than that. I may mention this, but again, this is like a typical.
If you make up a story with the words.
Of course, yes. If you manage, some people told me that they managed to make up a story very quickly and then they can recall more. So we are in this experiment, we were roughly here 12 words, and this was, you know, you had 6. So it's more or less, I can tell you, you are pretty average. Studying theoretical physics or neuroscience apparently does not make direct bearing on this. Okay, so how would you model this? And now here I have to give you a little bit of a background about how in theoretical neuroscience memory is modeled. So we have this paradigm, kind of intellectual framework to study, to understand the memory, which is called Hopfield model. So let me just very briefly tell you what Hopfield model is about before I really go back to this recall paradigm. So Hopfield model postulates that the memories are encoded in the brain by some kind of neuronal groups, right? So you have a Just imagine you have a very, very big memory network that encodes memory. So it has a lot of neurons here in this network. And every memory is just a random sample of these neurons, right? So original Hopfield model said that all of the neurons are encoding all the memories. And the difference between different memory patterns is like plus minus one. So pretty much like magnetic system. So you have plus and minus ones. And every memory will be a particular realization of this random choice of plus and minus ones. Okay, so this would be one memory, let's say a memory for your name, right? So every time you think of your name, one of these patterns would raise up in the brain. And the way these patterns are becoming memory is by means of modifications of the connections between this between this unit. So every unit that a plus one in a particular memory gets strong connections. Every two units which are minus one also get strong connections, but units that are connection between units, one of them is off and one of them is on, is actually negative, so it's weak. And so you can now imagine that if I randomly activate a subset of this pattern because of this strong connection, this will be completed, and then you will recall your name. So there were so the main kind of landmark study of this model was done in 1985 by Amit Gutfredson-Polinsky from Jerusalem. They did the statistical mechanics of this model. They calculated the number of memories that you can store in this network before it breaks down because of the interference between different memories. So there is a celebrated result that the maximum number of memories that you can put is should be less than a certain factor, C, times the number of neurons. And this factor was estimated about 0.14. Okay, so the bigger the network is, the more memories you can recall. So every memory is like a minimum in a certain attractor landscape, and then if you recall the memory, you just fall into this into this attractor. So my contribution to this field, this was late 80s and early 90s, was that I proposed some modification of this model, which took into account the fact that memories that neurons are not equally cannot be described really by plus minus one. Variables, but a neuron can either be active or not. So more natural description is 0, 1. So you can keep the picture, but think about this as zeros and this about ones. But more important is that there is a sparse encoding. So there is experimental evidence that the number of units that are participating in encoding memory is usually a very small fraction of the cell. So you can think about memories as kind of subgroup, very sparse subgroups, neuronal subgroups in this big network. So there is one parameter here that specifies how sparse this representation is. So let's say F is much less than one. And if you do things correctly, if you modify the learning rules correctly, then this model has a better performance than the Hopfield model. In terms of the overall capacity. So the number of patterns then can be proportional to n, but it's also depends on the sparseness. So if the encoding becomes very, very sparse, you can store more memories in the network. Okay, so this is kind of a background in the Hopfield model and its modification from late 80s and the beginning of the 90s. And this model explains, so it's a very appealing concept because it kind of has all the aspects of memory in one model, right? You have a remembering, which is the modification of the interactions between neurons, and you have a recall, which is this falling into the attractor. Yes?
Is this all, what would be low temperature?
This would be low temperature, right? If you have high temperature, then you'll start wandering, and so if you are a little bit of schizophrenic, then you will just never converge to one memory, but just jump between them. So that precisely brings me to the point of the recall paradigm, because this thing works very well if you have a specific cue for each memory. So if, let's say, I remind you of something, so I initialize the network close to one of these states, then the network will fall into the attractor and you will recall something, right? I'll ask you a question, let's say, what's your name? What's where do you live? This would be like a kind of some cue, and then this cue will allow you to recall the information that I'm asking you about. But as I said, in the real life, it's not always that we have cues, and that's where memory usually fails us, right? We know something, but we cannot access it because the cue is not good enough. And this recall paradigm is really an extreme case of this situation where there is no specific cues to something that I want you to recall, right? I gave you a random list of words, and instead of giving you a cue, I could give you a cue for each word. I could say, what was the... there was some profession there, what was it, right? Instead of this, I just say, just try to recall all the words. And that's what makes it a difficult, challenging task. So how would you think about a Hopfield model under this situation where I don't really give you a cue for each item, each memory, but I kind of isolate a set of items, a set of memories, and say, try recall all of them. So obviously you will need some process of going from one memory to another. So you will recall one memory, and then there must be something that will bring you from a memory to another memory. And here we, based on some, so we just played around with this Hopfield network. We introduced some mechanisms of going like from one attractor to another. And then, so what we realized that under some conditions, there is a very simple rule according to which Hopfield model kind of hops between the attractors. And the rule is like that. So if you assume that you are now fall into this attractor, which I shown here, and then let's say there is a bunch of other attractors that correspond to other memories that you have. So under many conditions that you can play with, the transition will be to another attractor which has the largest overlap with the one that you currently have. So if you, let's say this is attractor number one, and this is attractor number two, this is attractor number three, and there is a bunch of other things. So you will choose the next one by looking at how many neurons are encoding in this overlaps in this encoding groups, right? And in this case, you will make a transition to this attractor, right? So that's a very simple idea, right? It makes kind of some sense. Yeah.
I don't understand your picture at all.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, every neuron participates in each attractor.
No, because it's a sparse encoding. So there are neurons.
So you're just in this limit of sparse encoding.
Yes, I'm talking about rather sparse encoding, where not every neuron is participating in order. Let's say you have 10% of the neurons are participating in each attractor. Right, then there will be only 1% of the neurons in this overlap on the average, but there will be a variability, so you will just choose the one that is largest.
And is there an assumption here that the encoding is local?
No, there is nothing, no sense of locality here. I'm really assuming here complete, just for the drawing I have it local, yeah. But just think about these neurons which are everywhere in the network. Of course, it's a huge simplification because we have, our language is very structured, right? But in these experiments, they choose words completely by chance. So there is no obvious structure in the words in the list that you can identify. So in these conditions, I think that's quite a good approximation.
You get the same pattern if you give people a list of numbers?
I don't know of this of the results like that. Yeah. I remember I saw experiments like that, but they didn't study the numbers. They studied like the more subtle things.
These memory. Yeah. Contests. They get lists of words. They also get lists of numbers.
Right. Yeah. And some people are very good even remembering the order, etc. Yeah. Okay. So this is I'm almost done with describing now the model that I want to analyze. So I have these random encodings they have this sparse, they are sparse, so they are characterized by this number n that is smaller than 1. I'm assuming that the transitions occur according to these rules. And just one more rule that I have introduced, that I am forbidding the transition to go immediately back to where you just came from. So if from this attractor you would want to go back, I make cross on this transition, so I will search for another memory that has a second largest overlap. So in this case, let's say this would be attractor number 4. Okay, so instead of going back here, you go here. So that's a very simple model, so you can simulate it in a very simple way. So let's see what it predicts us about this thing. So how does it correspond to this experimental result? So why is it that you will not recall all the attractors? Because you will recall some of them, and then eventually you will converge to a loop. And because I'm assuming this is a completely deterministic model, so these encodings are random, but after I fix my encodings, the model itself is completely deterministic, so it will just continuously circle over the same memories, and some of the memories will never be recalled. So what do we expect? Like, what kind of scaling behaviors we expect when the number of words becomes large? Okay, so another way to visualize this is to have a graph. So let's have a graph where every node is a memory that we want to recall. Say there is a certain number of nodes in this graph, and there is an arrow that going from a node to some other target node. So let's say here you have let's put a solid arrow to another node that has the largest overlap, and then let's say put a dashed arrow to another item. Okay, and here let's say there is a solid arrow going here, and a dashed arrow here, etc. Right? There is a solid here, and let's say dashed here. So you have this combination of solid and dashed arrows, and the rule is that you start from a certain node, and you follow the solid arrow, and then you just continue until unless you go into this two items loop, then you have to follow the dashed arrow. So you choose either solid or dashed arrows like that, and you wait until you converge to some loop, and then you count how many items you visited before you converge to a loop. I don't know how to solve this. This is a very easy formulation. I don't have a complete solution to this model. So let me show you just a simplification, a further simplification of this that tells you what do you expect, and then some approximate solution to this model. So let's approximate this graph by a random graph where you just put arrows by completely randomly, right? So forget about these representations, forget about overlaps. Just let's look at the graph, which has only solid arrows. So from every node, you just choose the target by chance and put an arrow to the target and follow the arrows. So how many, what is the statistics? So you will get some trajectory on the graphs, which will look like this. And then you just continue, right? This will be a trajectory that you'll get, obviously. At some point, you will start circling. And you can very easily write the distribution for the length of these trajectories. Because if all the arrows are completely randomly placed, then the chance that you will have exactly k nodes here before you converge to a loop, it can be written like this. So the probability that you have a k node out of L that you have will be 1 minus 1 over L. So this is the chance that after the second node you don't go immediately back, then it will be 1 minus 2 over L all the way to minus k over L. I'm neglecting all these minus 1s here. Times k over L. Okay, so this means that you made k minus 1 steps without going back to already visited node, and then after this you choose one of the visited node. So this will be this probability curve. So that's the exact solution of the model, and you can approximate it in the limit where you have a large graph, and so if both k and L are very large, so you can write it as a product of exponentials. So then you can show that if you introduce this scaled variable k over square root of L, then you have a universal distributions of, can you still see here?
Yes.
Universal distribution of this scaled variable x, which will be x times e minus x squared over 2. Okay, so if you scale the number of words that you recall with the square root of total number of words that you have a universal distribution of these scaled variables. And this, so this predicts then that the average value of x will be square root of L with a prefactor that you can calculate, and the standard deviation will also be square root of L, etc. So all the statistics of this distribution can be easily predicted. Okay, so you see that by this very simple idea, so by simplifying one step more the model that we have, you have a very general explanation for this square root of L behavior.
Sorry, so this model is always assuming that, you know, this is in two dimensions.
No, there are no dimensions here at all. Where is two dimensions here?
Well, in your graph.
No, there is no dimension here because the arrows can go anywhere. So I just draw it on the board.
Okay, but so this is in
it's an infinite dimensional graph, yeah. Because there is no sense of closeness here, the distance. The chance that I put an arrow doesn't depend on where I draw these dots. Okay. Yeah.
What's behind the assumption that you started one place and only once and not started another place when you,
Okay, that's a very, very good question that really bothers me a lot. Why wouldn't you just, after you recall a number of words, just erase all of this and start it all over again? Okay, so this would mean that if you have this thing, why don't you just have another word? So, in fact, you can do this experiment. What will happen in the model is that you will recall a few more words and then you converge to the same thing. So you may recall a few more extra words. So this is an experiment that I don't know that anybody done, but you can calculate how many more words you will recall after you, if I remind you of a word that you forgot to recall.
I mean, it won't necessarily fall into the same loop, will it?
Sometimes it may actually find another loop. And then you will recall a whole bunch of new words. Yeah. And I don't know if anybody did this experiment. But the deep question here is, can you really erase this thing and start a new, on will? And I'm not, apparently, there is something that prevents us from forgetting what you just did. So in a sense, this experiment is not really very clean.
You test this by having people mouth the words as they try to recall them?
So some people just ask people just to come up with any words that come to mind. And this is very difficult to interpret, because sometimes they just keep repeating words, but sometimes they say some other words that were not even in the list. It's difficult to interpret this. When they are doing experiment in a standard way, they practically never have these random words, at least at the when the list is not too long. You know, when you go to very, very long list, sometimes you start making mistakes. But overall, the number of mistakes here is not too big.
I'm just asking whether you can record the trajectory.
So sometimes they see when people make actually record this loop.
Ask your subjects to mouth.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody did this explicitly like that. Yeah, you had a question.
So I was going to ask the same question, but then I thought you would answer that just changes the prefactor in front of root L. Okay, so you'll remember, three starting points or something. Not your answer, though, somehow. Why does it bother you so much?
Because at the beginning I thought that if you just do it many times, eventually you'll just recall all the words.
Well,
if you can just randomly start a search from different word, then why don't you just recall all the words?
Oh, because you need to remember several starting points, and how do you remember those? I mean, you'll probably have just to figure.
Yeah, but let's say you just by chance start from a new word. Eventually, I mean, if you just put noise into this model, you'll recall all the words. So for some reason we cannot put noise.
But But that's not true, because you have a lot of words that are not related to the experiment. So most likely what happens is that you escape.
That's another idea. Another idea would be that the reason that you cannot recall more words is that you cannot stay within this group. I agree. I don't know. I assume here that you can always stay within the list that I provided.
Yeah. So I suppose the model can predict what happens if the experimenter give a new word as a hint.
Yeah,
to the subject.
That's what I said, right. I can calculate how many extra words you will recall.
Right, yeah. How many attractors there are, what
right.
the probability of jumping to the main.
Yeah, that would be an experiment that I don't know, I think nobody did. But, okay, so this is a very, more questions? Okay, so this is this kind of toy model where I don't have this representation, I have a random set of errors. So. The model that I'm interested in is not like that, because the underlying randomness here is coming from this sparse representation. So it means that if you write down this matrix of this overlap, so let's call it a similarity matrix between different words. So if you have if you just count let's call this psi I mu is the neurons that are encoding 0, 1. So 1 means that the neuron I is encoding memory number mu. And this is psi I mu means that neuron I is also encoding memory number mu. So if you take the product, you only count the neurons that are encoding both memories simultaneously. If you, I normalize it, it doesn't matter if you sum them up. So this will be my matrix, which will define how the errors here on this graph are placed. Okay, so this matrix, this is where the randomness is, right? I assume that these encodings are random. So this implies, kind of imposes some a very complicated statistical structure of on the errors here. So in particularly, as I said, there will be many of these kind of short loops of solid structure, but there is a lot of other regularities that is quite difficult to analyze. So. I can give you some intuition about what's the most important things about this regularity. So one important thing is that the symmetry of this matrix, so it means that there is a tendency to go back, but this we kind of eliminated by putting the constraint that you cannot go immediately back. But there are other regularities, namely that different attractors here have different sizes here, right? So some memories are encoded by more neurons than the others. So if you have a, let's say, bigger than average representation of a particular memory, then all the overlaps will be statistically bigger than of another memory that has a smaller representation. So this means that the rows of the elements of this matrix are not completely independent. So if you have elements of the same row have a positive covariances, right? Because this means that if this particular attractor is large, then its overlap with all other attractors will be statistically larger than the average. So there will be positive correlations between this. So I think that's the most important difficulty that will affect the result of this trajectory. That affect the statistics of the length of these trajectories. So you could, of course, just simulate the model, but there is a way, we found a way to kind of semi-analytically to solve this issue by approximating these similarities by a product of some uncorrelated random variables. So you can match the second order statistics of these elements by replacing this similarity. So let me go here. So I have a similarity overlap between two attractors that I defined here. I can approximate it as a product of three factors. So I say, let's calculate how many neurons are encoding a memory number mu times how many neurons encoding a memory number mu and some remaining random factor z. Okay, so this is each of these, I assume, are random Gaussian variables. So this is how big one memory is, this is how big another memory is, and this is the remaining randomness. So it turns out that you can match all the second order statistics by fitting the statistics of this remaining random variable. And then every time you are searching for a transition, every time you are looking for a target memory of where to go, let's say you are currently at memory number mu, you have to maximize this thing. Okay, and here you have this interplay between these two factors. So if the representation is very, very sparse, you can show that the important that the role of this factor is diminishing, and the role of this z factor is increasing. So you are going back to the situation where these overlaps are completely random quantities, and then you will go back more or less to the model with the random errors. If on the other side the encodings are not very sparse, then this becomes the most important factor, and then your loop becomes shorter, because if you have you will have a high chance to converge to a memory which has a high representation. So the effect of the size of the representation depends on this sparseness parameter f. So you expect to have the resulting performance depend on this sparseness parameter f. I don't know where I have it. Such that in a limit of a very, very sparse encoding, you should converge to square root behavior. But if it's not so sparse, you expect to have a shorter segments, shorter trajectories here. So we did this kind of calculation, and we found that the average performance, so the average number of words that you can recall, will then still be a power law of L. But the exponent of this power law dependency will depend on the sparseness, so it will be this formula, right? So again, it will converge to 1/2 in the limit where there is a very, very sparse encoding, but it becomes progressively worse if the encoding is not very sparse. Okay, so this is the scaling behavior of this model for any arbitrarily chosen sparseness parameter f. Okay, so if any of you are interested in the details of calculation, we're just taking it too long time, but we can discuss it offline at some of the free time.
So it goes to a log if f equals 1?
If f equals 1, basically it means that you will always converge, very quickly converge to the biggest memory, so there will be no scaling behavior with L. No matter what L is, you will always remember like two or three items. Okay. Yes?
Can the model be generalized to take into account the time it takes to recall a given thing? Because, for example, I have a phenomena at my age that recalling people's names, I know when they're in there, mm-hmm. but it takes me a little while often to bring them back up. How would you explain that?
Yeah, so that's a very a question with a lot of history. People studied experimentally how long it takes you to recall, and typically you can do it on yourself. It typically gets progressively longer time to recall more words if you just sit and do the experiment. And the way here I have no time, right, because I just have to transition very quick. But if you add some little bit of stochasticity into the model, then you can think about this as, you know, you converge to a loop, but you just go over this loop, and then once in a while you may escape and recall a few more words, and then you come back to a loop. So this would predict that people should kind of recall the words in a bursty way, right? They would get stuck for a long time, and all of a sudden they have this escape, and they would recall a few more words, and there is kind of evidence for this.
But how do you explain that I know it's in there?
How do you know that you remember? This is kind of meta memory. I don't know how you explain. Yeah.
Does the behavior include recency and primacy?
Yeah, there is a recency and primacy which I'm not really touching. Okay, so So what do we have right now? Let me summarize a little bit. So there is a very simple explanation for the power law. Square root is a special case. That's kind of a best case. And in the limit of very, very sparse encoding, you should converge to the power law. And the prefactor, you can either estimate numerically or you can try to do some estimates. Let me just give you a final result that we have that kind of summarizes what we know theoretically about this model. So you have a prefactor which is roughly 2.1. square root of L in the limit of F goes to 0. And if F doesn't go to 0, then you have these different powers which depend on F, and there will be a prefactor for every F that you can, again, if you want, estimate numerically. Right? This is extremely simple model to do numerical studies because, you know, all you have to do is just throw these random representations and just simulate the research. So now I want to tell you something really amazing, which I still don't know how to interpret it well. Because, and this is really very, very recent results that we have. Most of it is actually during this program, so really very, very fresh. So how would you, like what would be your take on this kind of equation? We have this parameter-free expression here, right? Which is completely universal. So I say, no matter what you try to remember, as long as it's a random things, I give you. And if I believe that the encoding in the brain is indeed very sparse, I give you exactly the number, right? I tell you that if you try to remember, I don't know, if you watched 100 movies over the last year, and if they are not related very well to each other, if I ask you to list them, you'll recall 21 movies out of 100, right? Of course, on the average, right? And of course, different people may be better or worse. So what would you make of this result? And I can also predict the statistics, right? I can calculate this. So I had some kind of a ring about it when I looked at the data. So I collaborate with Professor Michael Hanna from UPenn, who does this experiment. So he gave me a large data set where subjects had to recall lists of 16 words for many, many times. And it's only one L, so we couldn't, of course, test this power law dependency. So we wanted to see some non-interesting things about the data that would kind of be accounted for the model. So one thing you can see here is that you can say that not all the, as already hinted, not all of the memories are equally easy or difficult to remember, right? If you have a memory that is encoded by more neurons, on average it will be easier to remember. So you can calculate the probability that you recall a certain memory as a function of its size, and there is a very tight relation. So this is like a recall probability as a function of the size. Let's say this is a distribution of the sizes. There will be very tight relation. So this means that some, in the framework of the recall experiment, some words are easier to remember, some words are more difficult to remember. And this is can be easily checked.
Misha, yeah. The first one you choose also with some property that depends on the size, or you choose?
Let's just choose it randomly. It's not exactly the same, but let's just do it this way. So now you can, so what we could do is we have this huge data set, many subjects doing this experiment. So for every word, we can just empirically calculate what's the chance that this word is recalled when it's presented. And there was indeed some distribution. So some words.
It was the same words for all people.
Yeah, we have a pool of words, about 1,500 of words. And every time you choose 16 by chance, and then you just reshuffle every time. So nobody sees the same list twice, yeah.
But are you assuming that all different people have the same,
I didn't know what to assume. So this is empirical thing. So whether there will be some systematic differences. And there were some systematic differences. Some words are systematically easier to remember than the others. So I say there must be something in common between different people. So now you can say, so now you can look at this number as a proxy of the size. And then you can look at some more subtle things. So for example, you can ask, what happens if you choose only big words, only easy words? Will you recall more or less? Turns out, no, that if you recall, if you take only words on this side or on this side of the distribution, it doesn't make a difference. You will recall the same number of words because it's really the differences between the sizes matter. So you can look at the data and just pick the lists that by chance had the easier words, and then you see that there is no correlation, almost no correlation. People don't recall. On the other hand, there is a phenomenon here which is like a shielding. If you have a very big word, then it will suppress the recall of other words because it will attract the transitions to it. So if you have statistically, you recall few very easy words, you will end up recalling fewer words than otherwise, right? So there should be some kind of negative correlation between how many words you recall and how easy they are. And we found this in the data. So this was nice. So there was some kind of non-trivial correlation that the model predicts, kind of came out of nowhere, and you can show. But the real thing that kind of started convincing me that maybe something is more going on here is when I looked at the statistics of recall. Okay, so I have a 16 words, and let's just look at what how people do. And there is some kind of improvement. So let's just look at the first day. So let's take we had about 100 subjects. Let's look at them. How they did at the first day of the performance of the experiment, and just look at the distribution of the number. So let's say we have a 16 words in the list. Let's just have a histogram of how they recall these 16 words, and on the average they were around 8, I think 8, 9, I don't remember exactly, and there was some wide distribution. Okay, so this is a summary of this experiment for the first day of experimenting, and then if you simulate this model with 16 words, you had basically an indistinguishable histogram, right? So the model not only predicts exactly, more or less exactly, the average performance. So we, in this case, this was roughly 8-9 words out of 16, but it's kind of made a very good prediction also of the distributions across the subjects. Okay, so this really doesn't make much sense, right? Because it could come out anywhere, right? It could be 4, it could be 10. The distribution could be completely, you know, hard to think of any way to predict something that you have don't really know what's going on in the brain, and yet this distribution came out to be very, very close. Okay, so that's when we decided to turn it to experimentalists and do the experiment and see what do we get for this curve. So the reason we can do experiments now, and this is with Michelangelo Naim, who is somewhere sitting here. And these calculations were done, by the way, with Sandro Romanis, who is also somewhere here, but I don't see. Yeah, here. Okay, so we are now doing these experiments. The reason we can now do experiments is that there is this nice platform, Amazon platform, called Mechanical Turk. You don't need to have a lab, you don't need to have anything, you just code the experiment. People sit at their homes, they see words flashed on the screen, and then they type what they can recall. Okay, so it looks like a very easy experiment. You just choose a list of a certain length, you do experiment many times, and you measure how many words they can recall. Turns out not to be so easy. There are two things that can make experiment a bit more challenging, because if you are sitting at home and you having a list of 200 words, the chance is that you're not very motivated, really, so you'll miss some of them. So we need to get an estimate of how many words you actually encode, and this may depend on many things, may depend on your age, may depend on your motivation, may depend on how quickly we read the words. So we do another experiment where we just estimate how many words you actually encode. We do it by presenting then a pair of words, one from the list, another not, and asking me to point to the word from the list. So from this we can recalculate how many words you are encoding if you are given a set of words like this. So there is a curve which goes somewhere like this. So by the time you come to a few hundred words, it's becoming less than one half. Right? So here it's more or less you are encoding all the words and then you start missing the words. So obviously you cannot recall more than that, because this is something like you blinked or you didn't look at the, you know, you thought of something. So now we have this statistic. So we had some like large number of subjects that did this experiment. So we know, let's call this M, the number of words that are memorized. And we can run this function on this M. So we have a prediction. We have now a prediction of how many words you are supposed to recall. This is predicted, right? Theoretical. So let's say, okay, if you, for L, which is around 200, we know that M will be around 100. So R should be around 220, right? So that's kind of the orders of magnitude that we have. And here for 16 will be around 8. And for 8, I mean, obviously somewhere it will break down. Right? So we have this kind of range that we are now dealing with. And we just did these experiments. There are some other sociological problems that some people cheat. And actually, if you just let it run like this, then a lot of people will cheat for the reason that we have no idea why they do it. We had to restrict the. We found a way. Again, Mike Ahana, my collaborator, helped us by providing us with the addresses of 3,000 of subjects that they somehow selected that don't cheat. So we did the experiment, and literally, you know, over the last 3 weeks, we did the experiment, and then we have an absolutely amazing result. So the data that we collected really, you know, we have 6 points, so we have 8. 16, 32, 64, 128, and 256 words in the list. So we collected the average data, and they really look like extremely close to this predicted curve. Right? So if you estimate, do some like very primitive statistics, it's well within the 90% confidence. So we really can predict extremely precisely the average performance of the people in all of this situation. The only thing is that we don't know exactly how many words they really remember, right? So the way I think about it now is that you have these two processes. One is how well you can remember things, and this is no theory can of course predict because it depends on many, many things. And then there is a search process that tells me how many of these you can recall. And this seems to work extremely well, right? And I really don't know why it works so well, because the model is really, as you can judge, very primitive and has many kind of simplification that obviously our memory works much more complicated thing, but still it's obviously catching something from the search process that allows us to predict this recall numbers in a very precise way. So this is more or less my story. I think the way to go around this, I still see it's a little bit of a weak point that we have to empirically estimate this number of encoded words. So you can do experiment better. You can let people practice with this list of words in a random way. And then we can maybe eliminate this uncertainty. But for now, we are in this state of kind of amazement, and we are trying to see how to go from here. But it seems to work much, much better than what we imagined and when we started this project a few years ago. Thank you.
It seems to me these experiments you could get more interesting data. For example, if you have people saying the words as they recall them, you could test various things like these strengths, or they have to do with the order in which you said the words.
Yeah.
So is the first memory you come up with, or the second,
yeah,
correlated with the learning sequence?
Yeah. Now this was studied, really. The order of recall, here I assume that the order is completely random. The actual order is not completely random. And there is some tendency for you to go in the same order. Like if you recall a word, then the next word, there is a little bit higher chance, or not a little bit, depends again on many things, that it will be the next word in the list, but then it will break down. So you will not have a long stretches of words. And this is, I ignore here, because it doesn't really change so much the performance.
Another, so you talked about the remembering, there's also the laying down of the memory.
Yeah.
Learning.
That's what I call remembering.
It may not be remembering.
But what is it then laying down?
Order.
I see, or the order itself.
In a different order.
Right.
16 words in a different order.
Yeah. Okay.
So how did you know people were cheating? Was it just that it didn't?
It's very easy, because they recall, let's say, 100 words in the correct order. You just write down, probably. It's not so fast, super fast. You have a second and a half for a word. If you're quick, you can just...
But the interesting thing that they also admit that they cheat.
Yeah, you can ask them, and they say, yes, we did.
Could you do similar experiment with mice? See, hiding food at random places and see how much.
That's we have to discuss. I mean, it's very difficult. I don't know how to do these experiments with animals, mice or monkeys, whatever, because of the report. You have a very complex.
At food, you find the number.
Right. So you could teach them positions and. We're actually thinking about it, but every possible paradigm has some caveats. So.
I was wondering if you have things to store which come from very different modalities, like auditory stuff, images. Maybe they are stored in different parts of the brain.
Right, yeah. So then I wouldn't know even how to deal with this. Right.
But would you predict that if you were presented with numbers, you'd have the same?
For now, it's completely general. So it could be numbers, could be sentences. I would say that if you just have a random sentences in your list, everything that has no structure, every structure will change things, right? Because let's say you have a kind of systematic chains here, of course you'll remember better. But if there is no structure, and if there is still sparse encoding, I say there should be the same thing.
So, Michel, why is the performance so low, the M equal to 100? I mean, compared to the standing experiment, that's something like 50%?
Right.
Whereas in the standing
right.
experiment...
Right. So there was somebody, there was a famous paper back in the 1960s that did the recognition experiments for images and words. It was very famous, called Memory for 10,000 of Images. And they have a better performance. So for... the subjects of this study remembered more words than we here find. And this could be for many reasons. First, the experiment was done in a different way. The time for word was much lower. It was 5 seconds. We have 1 and 5 seconds. These people were in the lab, so they were all graduate students. They were more motivated. Our subjects just, again, sit at home. They are not particularly motivated. So. This is something that really you cannot predict. That's what I'm saying, that could depend on many, many different things. So we cannot say anything about this. But my guess is that the main difference was the time that we give for what. The more time I give you, the better chance you will have to remember this word.
Also, standing
had
only 5 subjects.
I had 5 subjects.
So this is all what's called short-term memory.
Which memory?
Short-term.
This is not short-term memory. As far as I'm concerned, this is long-term memory, because the time that it takes to do this experiment can be minutes. For me, short-term memory is something that you use, you know, immediately, like in a time scale of a second, right? When I speak and you understand me, you remember words in a sentence. That's short-term memory, because that's something that is still actively.
But you know. I won't remember these words tomorrow.
Yeah, you will not remember the message. You may still remember the message.